This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Coming up on Radio EcoShock.
Sea levels could rise as much as 20 feet by the end of the century. It's a bleak, even terrifying vision. But this is what scientists believe meltdown could do to us all.
It's a life or death choice. Like, are we on the side of life? Are we on the side of, you know, an animate world with humans and other life forms? Or are we throwing in with the machine?
The former presidency that we had with Mr. López Obrador was one in which science was not only not supported, but actually attacked in a very violent way directly by the president, accusing, for instance, a number of colleagues of laundering money and so on. And I was very surprised by this.
It's another jarring week for science and dismantling science. Severe consequences drowned in political theater and war. Professor Antonio Lascanos sees repression of science in the United States through the lens of political strongmen in Latin America. What can science killing in Nicaragua, Venezuela, Argentina, Brazil, and Mexico tell us about the Trump repression? Followed by the latest, like Goddard Institute for Space Studies building shut down soon, Naomi Klein asks, which side are you on? And sea level expert Robert Kopp, sounding the general alarm is not alarmism. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Wiped out in waves, never seen coming. Dancing in their graves, machines still humming. Keyword search, delete, delete. Billionaire score, mission complete.
Killing climate news. Fast and Furious, a mashup from the fire hose of April 2025. Is the famous carbon dioxide measuring station in Mauna Loa closing? Daily figures from the site stopped updating April 16th. The lab on the mountain is listed for cancellation in the Trump admin documents. But somehow the daily data is still available from USC San Diego at keelingcurve.ucsd.edu. April CO2 passed the 430 parts per million mark, the highest in the last 3 to 5 million years, long before humans appeared on this planet. Robert McGuire reports April 21st on Blue Sky. A few weeks ago, chemical lobbyists asked the Trump administration to shut down an EPA website showing the locations of thousands of dangerous chemical facilities. The EPA just took it down. That's right, the government's chemical disaster tracking tool just went dark. You don't need to know where all that deadly stuff is, you with your sick kids and your dad with cancer. Mike Ludwig at Truth Out reports, quote, the Trump administration also deleted the Council on Environmental Quality's Climate and Environmental Justice Screening Tool, which the Biden administration set up to map out areas vulnerable to pollution and climate impacts, such as flooding and wildfires. Ludwig continues, the EPA quietly announced that a list of nearly 70 aging coal-burning power plants received a presidential exemption from rules requiring reductions of harmful pollutants, including mercury, arsenic, benzene, and fine particulate matter that lodges in human lungs, end quote from Mike Ludwig.
Radio EcoShock.
In 1633, Galileo faced the Roman Inquisition. He was accused of heresy for saying Earth circled the sun and not the other way around. Under threat of torture, he was forced to recant his views and spent the rest of his life under house arrest. In the United States, scientists are suddenly being fired with their funding cut. Some receive death threats, and most are fearful to speak. Why do humans fall in love with science and then turn against it? Is this a fundamental weakness in our minds that could limit progress, understanding the planet? Antonio Lascano is a science professor at the National Autonomous University of Mexico, known as UNAM. He promotes the study of evolutionary biology and the origins of life. His 250-plus publications are highly cited. Lascano also specializes in scientific journalism and teaching. On April 17th, he published this editorial in the top journal Science, When State Support for Science Fails. Looking at America dismantling science, can we find a map in the clash of politics and science in other countries before us? From Mexico City, Antonio Lascano, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
Why did you write this editorial for the journal Science?
The former presidency that we had with Mr. López Obrador was one in which science was not only not supported, but actually attacked in a very violent way directly by the president, accusing, for instance, a number of colleagues of laundering money and so on. And I was very surprised by this. And then actually looking at what's going on today in the United States, which has without doubt the most powerful scientific system in the world nowadays, I was amazed to see that the same was happening there. Mr. Trump certainly belongs to a much more conservative political position than Mr. López Obrador. And for me, it was very curious to see that regardless of the ideological attitude, both people from the right and from the left had this opposition to the development of science. And then I began looking at the situation in Latin America, and I was very surprised to realize that the same was going on in our part of the world with Ortega in Nicaragua taking over the Nicaraguan Academy of Sciences, with people like Meli in Argentina attacking science, Bolsonaro in Brazil, the former president of Brazil doing the same. And then it lighted upon me that the real problem is that in Latin America, regardless of our rather strong historical connections and identity, we have been unable to develop a scientific policy for the entire region. And it's something I'm very concerned about.
Yes, when I look at science papers and interview scientists, I often find Latin America and South America are almost completely missing. Yes, we talk about the Amazon, but there's a great hole in what we don't know about South America and Latin America. Would you talk to us a little bit more about what happened in Venezuela under the dictator Nicolas Maduro? We have a 2024 article in Nature saying scientists in Venezuela are afraid to talk. Many have left the country and more want to. What happens to a country with no scientists?
No modern democracy can survive without science. I have to say that quite explicitly. Science provides a way not only of understanding what surrounds us, not only understanding the nature of the universe, of the environment, of ourselves, but also is a way of making knowledge available to all of us. And when you teach science, when you do outreach in scientific research, you are actually democratizing scientific knowledge. In the case of Venezuela, which is obviously a dictatorship, what you have is the absolutely lack of understanding of former President Chavez, current President Maduro, having very little support for science. And I think what they do, what they have done or what they do now is to think of science as done by an elite, and being strongly populist, having a strong populist attitude for them. An elite of a group of experts, a group of specialists, is something they can quite easily identify and promote as enemies of the people. If you listen to the speeches of Mr. Maduro, for example, what you realize is that he's appealing all the time to common sense. Well, common sense is useful if you want to cross the street, but it doesn't provide you an understanding of the intricacies of ecological relationships in a given country. I think that science is an essential component of any current democratic culture.
Few people realize that Brazil is a major fossil fuel producer. They are the largest for petroleum in South America and the ninth largest in the world. How has science fared in Brazil?
Well, Brazil had a superb scientific community in the 60s. It was growing. The same was true in the case of Argentina. The same was true in the case of Chile. And then in the 70s, Latin America was strongly struck by military coups that ended up democratic regimes for a number of times. It's interesting to realize, for instance, that if you read Charles Darwin Travels, the Journal of Travels, you can see how he describes General Rosas, who was one of those caudillos typical of Latin American political culture in the 19th century. Well, caudillos normally have a very little understanding of the significance of culture and of science, and the same was true in the 1970s. Brazil's growing community, scientific community, was strongly weakened by the dictatorship. Many people had to leave the country. And when democracy returned, you had a flowering group of students, of researchers. And they were, of course, very concerned, as all of us should be worldwide, about the future, the fate of Brazil. Now, we'll know how attacks by people there have no understanding of the significance, the ecological, the worldwide significance of the Amazon, had to face very serious threats. If you look at the number of people defending the environment that had been killed worldwide by illegal wood trade, by the destroying of the tropical forests and so on, you can understand the ordeals these people face. Well, happily, there are a number of European, how shall I say, foundations or groups, mostly Germany and Norway, they are supporting very strongly the groups of scientists protecting the Amazon, and this has certainly relieved the pressure, the political pressure that our Brazilian colleagues had to face.
There are many models in Latin America of how the new science purge by the Trump administration may unfold. Let's talk about another case from your editorial. Trump is very fond of the president of Argentina, Javier Milei. Talk to us about how science setbacks in Argentina are going.
Well, one should keep in mind that about three decades ago, Argentina had two Nobel awards given to scientists, and it was an extraordinary sophisticated scientific environment. I remember when, as I got undergraduate students, I was reading all the time the books published by a publishing house called Eudeba. The translation will be Editorial Universitaria de Buenos Aires, which was very, very sophisticated. I've been twice to Argentina, and I had always felt at home. And given their sophisticated, their complex scientific and cultural life. Well, it turns out that Mr. Milei, the current president, has a very little understanding of the significance of science. He has cut the budget for science. He has threatened academic liberty. And if you look at the entire Latin America, and let me use Argentina as an example of what's going on, you see that we have an extraordinary identity, cultural identity. We have very strong common historical roots. And one thing that makes me extremely envious of the European Union is the fact that they have developed what they call the Erasmus program, in which you can have an undergraduate from Denmark going to Greece or a graduate student from Germany working in Spain. If a German student can feel at home in Spain, or an undergraduate girl from Denmark can work without any problem in a lab in Greece, it will be in principle more easy for, let us say, an Argentinian undergraduate student to feel at home in Guatemala. We have been unable to develop an equivalent program to the Erasmus in Latin America. And nowadays, well, since several centuries ago, science depends very strongly on exchange of ideas, on the free exchange of ideas, on the mobilizing people from one country to the other. And unfortunately, this has not been a goal of Latin American governments or societies for several decades.
And getting back to Mexico, your country elected a climate scientist, Claudia Sheinbaum Pardo. if I understand your editorial, this change may not be enough because we can't have this back and forth of politics every few years. Great science needs long-term stability, yes?
Absolutely. I think that, yes, indeed, the current president, whom I know, I mean, she was an undergraduate student at my school. Her mother was my TA. Her mother is also a scientist, was my TA for a year or so. But it doesn't, clearly, it doesn't suffice to have a scientific background if you're going to be a politician. What you also need is a very elaborate democratic system like those like that in Germany, where another scientist like the former Chancellor Merkel was able to develop a very, very elaborate, very proper response to the epidemic, the SARS epidemic, thanks not only to the fact that she was trained as a chemist, but also to the fact that the government recognizes, and that's a state in the laws of Germany, recognizes the significance of the advice of scientists and the academic community. The same could be said, for instance, of England. Remember that Mrs. Thatcher was a chemist. She had a good background in chemistry. A couple of friends of colleagues of mine that I haven't seen for a while actually were together with her in classes, and they recalled that she was an actually good chemist working on asymmetric synthesis. But then we saw the disaster that came on when she was unable to understand the significance of science and culture for the development of the UK system.
So, Antonio, what can the history of repression of free science in Latin America tell us about current defunding of climate science in America? Are there lessons we can learn there? Can we see something coming?
I think that one has to keep in mind that no modern democracy can be strengthened as such in the absence of a strong scientific system. Science is a universal patrimony. Science is something that has not only the system has a right to develop, but also should be reinforced as part of the politics of any current modern society. You're speaking of climate change. I will also speak about biodiversity, about the alternative developments of alternative energy sources, about the need to have a proper use, knowledge and use of our biological and mineral resources. And unless we develop a common policy for Latin America, I think we will be doomed for, to quote Garcia Marquez, for 100 years of intellectual solitude.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock from Mexico City. Our guest is Antonio Lascano, professor at the National Autonomous University of Mexico. We are talking about repression of science in the Americas. When scientists are vilified on television and social media, like Anthony Fauci has been in America, that seems to erode public trust in scientific results. And then we get conspiracy theories and religious ideas might replace real science. How do you see it?
Well, I think it's interesting to say that for all the prejudices that exist in the Anglo-Saxon world, countries that have a strong Catholic background, like, for instance, Latin America, have no problem with science. For instance, only twice in my life I've had any problems with people preaching against evolution. And in both cases, they came from the USA. In Latin America, the ideas of Darwin are prosper and are very well accepted. So I don't think that the religious issue is that strong. My problem is that, or I should say the problem that everybody has, is when you disconnect the richness of scientific understanding from public and political policies. I think that's a real issue. There's an anecdote that I wonder how well known it is in the United States, but I think it's very significant. There is a recent paper published in Nature in which a professor from Stanford analyzes the strength of American sciences, which by all means is the most, is the strongest worldwide. And he argues, and I think he's right, that during the Second World War, an extraordinary American engineer, Vannevar Bush, convinced President Roosevelt that one should develop an alliance between industry, universities, and the government in order to make science an element in the war against the Nazis. And then when the Second World War was coming to an end, Bush wrote in a very famous piece that if science helped to win the war, science should help us to keep and maintain peace. Well, the outcome of that policy is an extraordinarily strong American scientific system as that in the United States. Many people are not aware that during his first term, Mr. Trump actually accepted that kind of advice. In early March, the 2020, when the epidemic, the pandemic was raging worldwide, he actually met with the leaders of the pharmaceutical industry, with a number of scientists like Dr. Fauci, and Mr. Trump offered political support, fiscal facilities for the pharmaceutical industry to develop medicaments, to develop vaccines. And the outcome was the very quick development of the messenger RNA vaccines. As Dr. Fauci says in his memoirs, the Trump administration should be fairly proud of the fact that alliance was made in 2020. It's a pity that Mr. Trump hasn't followed the same policy nowadays.
Well, people like Musk and Peter Thiel say, let business do it. Do you see a focus on applied science and commercialization of science as a danger? Can billionaires and private companies provide all the science we need?
Well, I think that big money has to be controlled democratically by societies. I have absolutely no qualms about seeing big money companies and so on doing applied science, as long as the applied sciences doesn't mean forgetting about basic science. In the 19th century, Claude Bernard, a rather well-known physician, French physician, said that it's not good to separate science into basic science and applied science. You have either good sciences or not. No one would have guessed, and this is the centenary year of quantum mechanics, when support was given to quantum mechanics a century ago, nobody would have guessed that nowadays we will be using it in laptop or cell phones.
Do you think American foreign policy has contributed to the instability of scientific research in Latin America?
Quite on the contrary. I think that if you examine the many treaties and exchange programs that we used to have until recently, nobody knows what's going to happen to them in the near and medium-term future. Actually, the exchange program was quite extraordinary. I should underline the fact that Latin America science was enriched by the interaction with USA science, scientific community. I remember a very good friend of mine when he was appointed head of the biophysics and biochemistry department at the University of Houston, calling me and telling me, okay, we are quite close to Mexico. I'm head of the department. What can we do to promote exchange programs? I myself had a tremendous intellectual debt to my American scientists and colleagues who became my professors. So I think that any reasonable foreign policy of any country should actually promote those academic exchanges. And we have a direct example, dear Alex, of what can happen otherwise. Brexit actually cut in a terrible way the scientific ties of the UK with the rest of European science. And that has damaged British science in a terrible way, cutting support for projects, complicating the possibility of young scientists being trained in the UK and so on. So nowadays, the scientific system forms such an closely interwoven web that it's impossible to think that any country can be isolated either by foreign policies decisions or by cutting support or cutting exchanges and have a healthy scientific and educational system.
A lot of scientists that I talked to were baffled when their work with bugs or peat bogs or glaciers became political. They don't see research as a political issue. If we try to make a better world, can you, Antonio, think of arrangements or institutions which can protect long-term development of science and its accomplishments?
Well, not even continental drift will separate the United States from Latin America. We have to profit both parts of the continent from that very close relationship. Historically, geographically, the United States scientific development is tied to what goes on in Latin America. And remember that in the start of the 17th century, Giordano Bruno moved from Italy to Oxford. He was eventually kicked out, but because he was not an easy character. But remember that he's an example of those exchange of scientists, both male and female, that took place all over the world.
You spent a busy lifetime investigating the origins of life. I know you've been asked this 1,000 times, but if you had to bet, would you pick life arriving from space or something that happened biologically here on Earth?
I think life is a local phenomenon, but I think that one of the most outstanding results of NASA is the demonstration that if you look at the surface of Mars, of Venus, of the satellites of the outer planets, you see the remains of collisions with comets, asteroids, meteorites in the earliest stages of the history of our planetary system. I think that is telling us that a huge number of volatiles of carbon, nitrogen, hydrogen, water sources enriched in a very significant way the surface of the Earth, and that actually provided the environmental condition for the synthesis of organic compounds and their evolution into the first cells.
Humans try to interpret evolution as a process leading to our wonderful selves. You teach that natural selection has no foresight, no goals, only results. Is life really that blind and cold?
Yes, but don't forget that blindness is guided by natural selection. Selection is a very powerful force, as Charles Darwin demonstrated in 1859 in The Origin of Species, that actually combines the randomness of the diversity of population with root that selects the most stable, most highly reproducible, more efficient systems.
Do you think there's a fundamental weakness in our minds that could limit scientific progress, understanding life on this planet and beyond, a kind of psychological barrier that we're running into now in the United States and in Latin America and other countries?
No, I don't think that that has to do with psychology at all. I think that our psychological framework actually provides us with the richness of the intellectual curiosity to be open to new ideas, to defend the former ones, and to come out with reasonable results. I think that, on the contrary, I think that curiosity, intellectual curiosity, is a defining trait of human minds.
As we finish our time together, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
Well, I would like to, first of all, thank you for the time, for this exchange. Secondly, I would like to thank the media, because the media in Latin America and the United States have been all in all quite supportive of the efforts of science. One should remember the role that the media had, for instance, during the pandemic. I don't know if you had the chance to see the extraordinary articles by Carl Zimmer in the New York Times explaining what the virus is, how virus evolved, what the vaccines are. And I think that the media, all sides of media, whether the printed press or the web or radio programs and so on, has opened an extraordinary possibility for people to communicate, to exchange ideas. And what I would really like to say is that using the richness of the media, this possibility, is that our American colleagues should feel very supported by the Latin American community of scientists that recognizes without any problem the need to have a good scientific exchange that can enrich it, all of us. I mean, without the media, there's a quote by Carl Sagan that I always mention to my students. When he brought the obituary of Isaac Asimov in Nature, he underlined the role that Asimov had in doing scientific outreach in books, in lectures, in the media. And he says, I remember that quite well, that the ultimate goal of Asimov was to democratize scientific knowledge. And I think this is actually what you are doing.
From Mexico City, we've been speaking with the well-known voice of science, Dr. Antonio Lascano. You can find links to his editorial, his published works, and my notes on science repression in Latin America, all in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Antonio, you were generous to share this time with our listeners. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
When it comes to artificial intelligence and your ghost life in the data farm, which side are you on? Naomi Klein is famous for her book, Disaster Capitalism, and her latest book, Doppelganger, A Trip into the Mirror World. We covered that on EcoShock. On April 19th, Naomi spoke with Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Here is a clip you need to hear.
There was a similar kind of AI push in the early days of COVID, where a lot of these big tech companies, and this was really for the bailouts, if it's needed. So they're not worried about the case in Chile in the sense that the Chicago boys' economic policies backfired massively under Pinochet, and even though it was done in the name of reducing inflation, it actually led to inflation spiraling. And then there were the bailouts, right? I mean, because this is the thing, is that they win either way. And I think this is what's important, and I think a lot of people do understand this about Trump's economic team, is that you've got people who are very skilled at profiting from both a market upturn and a market crash, right? Especially if they have their hands on the levers that allow for the bailouts if it's needed. So they're not worried about the consequences of their economic wreckage, particularly. But I do think that, you know, he did have to draw back from some of the tariffs just because I think partly he hadn't reckoned with the, and this is what I mean about history being cumulative, right? Like, because we are, you know, 50 years into the neoliberal project, the economy is much more financialized than it was, you know, when there was the Nixon shock, for instance. So some things stay the same and some things change. But you're talking about the nihilism at the heart of this project. And that's really what I've been grappling with. And I think a lot of us have been, where we're like watching right. this and we're like, okay, don't you also have to breathe air and drink water? Like, okay, maybe you can send your kids to private schools, you're not worried about what happens to public schools, and these folks are all grifters and they see all kinds of market opportunities in education. I think it's really important to understand that, not just in the sort of for-profit university or like Jordan Peterson seminar racket, right, which is very real, but also just the AI, the idea that AI should be teaching our kids, that a lot of the work of education in K-12 and post-secondary can just be done through AI. And this is a bipartisan project. And just if I could just add a little factor, which I think is important for us to remember as we're bombarded with information, there was a similar kind of AI push in the early days of COVID, where a lot of these big tech companies, and this was really being spearheaded by Eric Schmidt, you know, formerly CEO of Google, saying, okay, well, in the name of the pandemic and, you know, keeping us safe from this virus, we're going to have this Build Back Better, which is really going to digitize everything, right? So we'll have, and it was also couched much as we are in this moment of, you know, China is out AIing us. They use more right. telehealth. They have more smart, so quote unquote, smart cities, which are cities where you have AI embedded in absolutely everything. So Eric Schmidt went on a major lobbying campaign, sort of rebrand COVID recovery as this major, major push for AI everything in schools, in healthcare, in cities. And the person who took him up on this was Cuomo as governor. He put him in charge. I mean, he was incredibly excited about this. So this is not just a Republican a move. And as we know, there are a lot of powerful corporate Dems who have very deep ties to many of these Silicon Valley figures who have been pushing for exactly this. It turns out that it's, not Cuomo, but Trump who is opening up, all of the doors for their wildest dreams. So AI, in addition to all of the things that we should worry about AI, in terms of its impacts on jobs, in terms of its impacts, even in the dystopian sort of AI singularity nightmares that we hear about, as somebody who's been engaged in the climate, struggle for a long time, what worries me most immediately about AI is that this is really a vampiric technology, right? In the sense that, a vampire technology in that it builds this mirror world of our world by draining our world of what we need to live, right? Like of water, of energy, of a habitable climate, because it devours energy on such a huge scale. So this is another way that this Trump agenda is really at war with just life on Earth. You have this deregulation of, health and human services and environmental regulations. And by the way, we have not even seen the start of it. They've got all kinds of big plans apparently for Earth Day where they're going to really, really declare war on the whole NGO sector. But then you have AI, which is really the massive environmental threat, because you've got Schmidt before Congress saying, well, we need to triple our energy use in order to meet our AI needs and keep up with China. It's basically this new Cold War discourse. So that's why I think the moment we're in is really different, because it's just simpler in the sense it's just so clear. It's like it's a life or death choice. Like, are we on the side of life? Are we on the side of an animate world with humans and other life forms, or are we throwing in with the machines?
That was Naomi Klein speaking on the Majority Report, April 19th, 2025. The title, which you can search on YouTube, is Trump's End Times Fascism, Naomi Klein. Climate killing headlines, you know they're true. New York Times, April 21st. EPA set to cancel grants aimed at protecting children from toxic chemicals. The cancellation set to apply to pending and active grants also affect research into forever chemicals contaminating the food supply. And that's by Hiroko Tabushi in the New York Times. Here's how it works. The tech brothers and billionaires prepare a hit list. Trump uses executive orders to kill off anything that bothers his particular mind, like wind turbines, or the minds of his lobbyists or people who buy into his meme coin. They cut everything and see who complains. If it is the CEOs on the phone or the Wall Street kings, it might be reinstated after all the staff were fired. Daniel Swain, heard last week on Radio EcoShock, now says, it looks like most regional climate center websites and data pages are coming back online, or will shortly, as funding has been, at least temporarily, restored. But the regional climate centers remain at risk, and it's clearly stated the goal of ending most NOAA funding climate research and monitoring. There remains concern that budget passback document leaked about 10 days ago, which zeroes out most climate funding for NOAA, would still, if enacted, result in the closure of the RCCs, and further concern re-executive branch request that agencies implement it ASAP before Congress finalizes. Scientist Zach Labe says due to strong support, funding for regional climate centers has been restored by NOAA and the Department of Commerce. But that may be temporary. There is no money for the regional climate centers in a leaked 2026 federal passback document, and that's to be implemented as soon as possible. These are desperate times over at America's flagship science operation, the Goddard Institute for Space Studies. Before Trump, about 1,000 people were employed there. The previous head of GISS was world-famous scientist James Hansen. Recently, another great scientist, Gavin Schmidt, took the helm. I followed his work and posts for years at realclimate.org. Schmidt has appeared on Radio EcoShock. Now Gavin Schmidt is reposting efforts to save, quote, numerous data sets scheduled for decommissioning in May, end quote. A group in the UK called Pangea is collecting as much American science as possible before it goes dark a few days from now. Meanwhile, the lease on the actual building for the Goddard Institute has been canceled. It must be emptied out in weeks, I think. This kills off one of the great hubs for science intertwined with Columbia University. The classic building has a restaurant on the ground floor, made world famous as the hangout for Seinfeld and his friends. No new building has been proposed. Schmidt told CNN, "The work continues, the data, the products, the science will continue, because science is done by people, not by buildings," end quote. CNN adds, a NASA spokesperson said in a statement, quote, "Employees would be placed on temporary remote work agreements while NASA seeks and evaluates options for a new space for the GISS team," end quote. As reported by Politico's Sarah Shornhart, Rubio eliminates office that oversees climate talks. The Office of Global Climate Change was notified Thursday it would be shuttered. The State Department is eliminating that office, and a State Department spokesperson confirmed the office is being eliminated to comply with the President Donald Trump directives to cease participation in international agreements.
Recent research paints a more disturbing picture. Sea levels could rise as much as 20 feet by the end of the century. It's a bleak, even terrifying vision. But this is what scientists believe meltdown could do to us all.
20 feet, 6 meters of sea level rise by 2099? Who says so? The producers of Naked Science on YouTube. That would be the UK independent film company Pioneer Productions. They specialize in disaster videos for more than 1.5 million subscribers. Their productions have aired on Discovery Channel, PBS, National Geographic Channel, and more. If there is an asteroid coming or something erupting, Naked Science is there for the fearsome spectacular. On the other hand, you do get snippets of science that can be confirmed and possible realities beyond the official line. As we see, official climate change predictions are often underestimates, too cautious, leaving out key forces. This YouTube video is titled, "Is a Climate Catastrophe Already Underway?" It is provoking and worth watching. Here is a sample.
Floods, storms, rising sea levels. Climate change is already altering the face of our planet. Freak weather is no longer out of the ordinary. It's becoming the norm. Our planet's ice is melting, and that changes everything. Seas will rise. Cities could be submerged, and millions may die.
There won't be any area near the coast that won't be hit hard.
It's inevitable that we're going to lose everything at the coast.
Now we separate fact from fiction to discover the real science behind climate change and the melting ice caps. Global warming. It's a term we hear all the time. But behind the familiar words is a frightening reality. Our planet is warming up, and the effect on Earth's ice caps is catastrophic. As temperatures go up, the ice is melting. Sea levels are beginning to rise. Around the world, ocean levels are increasing twice as fast as they were 150 years ago. In 2005, 77 cubic miles of ice from Greenland and Antarctica melted into the sea. For comparison, the city of Los Angeles uses about 1 cubic mile of fresh water per year. This is global meltdown. In 2001, scientists predicted that sea levels would rise by 3 feet by the end of the century. That's a big rise, enough to affect more than 100 million people worldwide. But now researchers like Bill McGuire, professor of geohazards, worry that the predictions might be wrong.
the official scenarios for sea level rise, if you like to call them that, were published in 2001, and they were based on research that was undertaken in the years running up to that. So they are completely out of date now.
Even conservative estimates predicted that over the next 60 years, rising seas would destroy a quarter of all the houses within 500 feet of America's coast. Recent research paints a more disturbing picture. Sea levels could rise as much as 20 feet by the end of the century. It's a bleak, even terrifying vision. But this is what scientists believe meltdown could do to us all. To understand what will happen when the ice melts, scientists need to study the processes driving the meltdown. Advanced modern technologies can reveal our planet's ancient history. By studying how things have changed in the past, they hope to predict our future. Sea level rise is nothing new. We know that in the ancient past, sea levels have been both higher and lower than they are today. It's a natural cycle, driven by the melting and freezing of the polar ice caps throughout Earth's 4.5 billion year history. When the ice caps melt, they release water into the ocean. When they freeze, they take it out again. Earth's climate alternates. There are ice ages when the temperature drops and the ice caps freeze and expand. And there are interglacial periods when the ice caps melt and release water back into the oceans. The cause of the cycle is the Earth's rotation around the Sun. Earth's orbit around the Sun varies in a number of complex ways. The most important is that it changes shape. It's not always a circle. Through a cycle lasting about 100,000 years, the orbit goes from being almost round to being stretched into an oval shape, then back again. In the more elliptical orbit, we travel millions of miles further away from the Sun. Less sunlight reaches the Earth, and an ice age is born. Right now, our orbit is circular, not elliptical, and we are in a warmer interglacial period. But something is wrong. The ice is melting too fast.
You just heard a sample from the YouTube video, Is a Climate Catastrophe Already Underway?, on the Naked Science channel. But let's see what a seasoned climate and sea level scientist is saying. Dr. Robert Kopp is a scientist and climate policy scholar at Rutgers University. He leads the Earth System Science and Policy Lab there. Bob Kopp is a world-renowned expert on sea level rise. He appeared in a video podcast from the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists on April 17, 2025. I'll play you a clip. The title is Beyond the Threshold, the Urgency of Climate Change.
Sea level has, I think many of you know, is sort of an integrated metric of how much heat we're trapping in the climate, right? As we warm the planet, we're putting heat into the ocean, which causes it to expand. We're warming glaciers, which cause them to melt. And on longer timescales and through somewhat more complicated physics are causing ice sheets to shrink, right? So all of those are contributing to sea level rise. We know from a combination of observations and geological records that sort of the modern era of global sea level rise started in the late 19th century. It has accelerated over time, particularly over the last 50 years. So the average rate of sea level rise in most of the 20th century was about 6 inches over the course per century. It's now about twice that. Looking at a slightly longer geological context, we can say with an extremely high degree of confidence that the rate of sea level rise since the beginning of the 20th century, since 1900, is faster than any century in at least 3,000 years and probably substantially beyond that. And we've already turned up the planetary thermostat and put more CO2 into the atmosphere than there's been in terms of the temperatures in over about 120,000 years, and in terms of the carbon dioxide, more than 3 million years. So there's a lot more sort of already baked in. Inez said that to stabilize the temperature, we have to stop emitting carbon dioxide. To stabilize sea level rise, you would have to do more than that. Because again, sea level is sort of this integrated metric of how much heat we're putting into the system. So as long as the planet is warmed, it'll sort of gradually equilibrate over thousands of years with that new higher temperature. So basically, the more we turn up the thermostat, the faster sea level rise will rise. But if we were to stop emitting now and stabilize the temperature, we will still see sea level rise for thousands of years into the future. We also know fairly confidently that over the next 30 years or so, through the middle of the century, there's a bunch of sea level rise baked in, regardless of what we do with emissions. So over the first half of this century, we'll probably have experienced between half a foot and a foot of sea level rise. As we get beyond that, sea level projections are more sensitive to how much we emit. Broadly, we would expect about 2 to 3 feet of sea level rise over this century if we don't hit thresholds within the ice sheets that destabilize them. But under a higher emission scenario, we could be looking at 2 to 3 feet of additional sea level rise on top of that. As we'll get to, I don't like the term tipping points for any of this, but there is that instability there. There are things we know well that are quite certainly in store for the rest of the century and beyond, but there's also potential for the ice sheets to contribute substantially more. And we have to make decisions now about how to adapt that sometimes require us to think into those deeply uncertain futures, because we have infrastructure around that will be around in 100 years, where we have a very broad range of futures available to us.
That was Dr. Robert Kopp speaking about sea level rise in April for a panel on the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. Link in my blog for you. From Kopp, it sounds like 4 to 6 feet, 1.2 to 1.8 meters of sea level rise by the end of this century. 4 to 6 feet, 1.2 to 1.8 meters by the end of this century, if we maintain high levels of emissions as we're doing now. That alone should flood downtown Manhattan and doom Miami, not to mention the megacities in Asia. Imagine the storm surge. But pay attention when Bob Kopp adds there are unknowns and possible rapid tipping points in glaciers, which could add even more. We don't know. Maybe it will be 10 feet or 3 meters higher sea levels by 2100. Twice that seems unlikely to me from the science we have so far, but we don't know. For most of civilization, sea levels were fairly stable going back thousands of years. From now on, the sea will rise higher and higher for centuries, no matter what humans do. That process has already been triggered. Unless there is an asteroid strike or a thousand-year chain of volcanoes going off, massive amounts of ice from the poles will fall into the sea. That transfers water that was sitting on the land down into the sea. Except for a few regions with rising land, all generations to follow will assume and live with a sea that is always encroaching further into the land and further in. That is one lasting legacy from the fossil fuel age.
President Obama promised to begin to slow the rise of the oceans and to heal the planet.
Well, without civilization collapse, let's say we have continuing health, let's say that the civilization is very resilient to global warming, then carbon dioxide levels are going to go extremely high by the end of the century, probably above 1,000 parts per million. If you think about 1,000 parts per million, well, that's probably, depends on what the climate sensitivity is, but that's something along the lines of 5 degrees Celsius warming, at least. And when we think of 5 degrees Celsius warming, people are familiar with this, usually start bringing up highly catastrophic scenarios. So in some sense, it's hard to imagine how civilization cannot be in pretty dire straits during this century.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay. None of that is news to our next guest. John Englander is the American oceanographer who literally wrote the book on rising seas. It's called High Tide on Main Street, now in an updated edition. He's been the CEO for the Cousteau Society and International Seakeepers. Englander founded the Rising Seas Group to advise governments, industry, and communities. But John Englander also has a degree in economics. He can speak to the developing financial cost and social rearrangements we either make or will be forced to make. John Englander, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Glad to be with you.
When it comes to rising seas, can we say that all of us are witnessing the birth of a new age?
Absolutely. In fact, it's hard to see it because it is so new. for 5,000 years, sea level hasn't changed much because the planet has been in a fairly stable climate regime. But when we look back millions of years and see the ice ages, we realize that climate did change naturally. But now we are broken out of that natural cycle without getting into detail, perhaps. But the fact is we are entering a new era after about 5,000 years of stability. And seas will rise. The ocean temperature is warming. Currents are changing. Temperatures, rainfall, all of that.
In the first edition of your book, you predicted the kind of damage that hit New York and New Jersey with Hurricane Sandy. How did you know?
Well, what I was describing was a scenario for what would happen if we had a superstorm that happened to come up the North Atlantic and head toward the Northwest and would happen to hit in Atlantic City, New York, and just to describe the kind of mega damage. The fact that that happened 1 week after my book was published surprised me as much as anybody else, frankly. I wasn't predicting it would happen then. I was describing scenarios to begin to help people see the future. A number of others have also happened that I described in my book as scenarios. But, you know, if you understand the physics properly and can look at the big picture, we all realize that to some degree we have a pretty good chance of our forecasts or our scenarios becoming true. And Hurricane Sandy was just an extreme example. Record-breaking temperatures and record-breaking storms and out of the pattern. And we need to get used to the fact that weather is going to become abnormal. In fact, abnormal will be the new normal.
Major European institutes join race to save U.S. science data. That was published April 24th in the journal Nature by Jeff Tollefson. They continue, as the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump slashes budgets, crucial data sets on climate and other subjects could disappear. After Trump was elected last year, Eric Nost, a geographer at the University of Guelph in Ontario, Canada, and other volunteers began backing up U.S. data, worried about the information disappearing. Trump 2.0 has lived up to expectations, Nost says, by endangering various kinds of data. But he adds that the situation at NOAA represents the first major threat to core data sets that are crucial for all kinds of environmental research. One scientist, who was recently fired from the agency, confirmed to Nature that the websites in question include data sets used in active weather forecasting operations. If those were to go out, it would be really bad, says the scientist, who asked to remain anonymous, because they fear retaliation while seeking new employment. That's a quote from Nature. This is in addition to an earlier alarm about the lost American climate data in Nature in February. The title of that one is Scientists Globally Are Racing to Save Vital Health Databases Taken Down Amid Trump Chaos. The mass archiving effort is in response to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention removing some of its web pages. So this is an all-hands-on-deck grab by scientists in many countries to make sure that crucial data that we need, just for weather forecasting, for storms, but also to know whether this world is going way too hot too fast, we need to know all that. Some scientists are trying to save it. Lordy, that is enough for 1 week, when every week seems like 10. Don't forget to give love and take love. That's so important. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
No stars aligned. Dust clouds choke skies, no more blue. Climate killing headlines, you know they're true. Fast fury rushing on a dead end. Gasoline disease. Oh, 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 oh. Ash rains down, yeah, melts my pride. Oh, ocean waves swell, swallow the tide.
gasoline disease. Can't stop this car, red light in the doom. Radio crackles impending. In motion, clock out of time. But we all burn with gasoline disease.